talking with Nancy Roman on 16th June 1978 at the IAU Symposium in College Park, Maryland. And could you start off by telling me what your educational background was and how you first came in contact with radio astronomy?
Well, my educational background was as an astronomer. Both my undergraduate and my graduate degrees were in astronomy. I did my thesis work, and the first part of the work after my thesis, on open clusters and the use of open clusters for calibrating absolute magnitudes of spectral types. And then I got from that, I guess basically from the cluster motion work, into galactic structure, and I did a fairly major job on high-velocity stars.
Actually,
I did spectral types of bright stars, intermediate and late-type bright stars, and discovered the weakening of spectral lines as a function of increasing space velocity. And from that, I got into the galactic structure work, high-velocity stars, that type of thing.
What school was this? Were you at
your
degree?
This was in Chicago.
In Chicago?
Yes, and I stayed on at Chicago on the faculty for another 6 years. And I was working, getting into the problem of metal abundances in stars as a function both of galactic Z distance and of the interorm region at the time I left Cherokee's. The reason I got into radio astronomy, two reasons. First, to be quite honest, I felt as a woman I had no future in the university. I could stay there until the tenure decision came up, and that would be it. And I decided I'd leave when a good job came along instead of waiting until I had to leave. And the job in radio astronomy came along, and I felt that in 1955 it was obvious that the radio astronomy had a great deal to contribute to galactic structure. And since I was interested in that subject, it seemed like a good opportunity.
But so, you had no background in this.
No,
sort
I had
of
no
thing.
Background at all in radio astronomy at all. You asked what my first contact with it was. I guess my first contact was a couple of years earlier. As you may remember, Reber did his work not too far from Yerkes.
That's right.
In Wheaton, Illinois,
right. Yes.
Which was, 40, 50
right.
miles. And so he had come up to Yerkes.
I've talked to him in great detail.
From time to time, and had given a couple of colloquia on radio astronomy.
And were you impressed by this?
Interested, I'd say, rather than impressed.
Yeah.
That was a few years earlier, of course, but by 1955, the 21-centimeter work had come along, and
sure.
It was very clear that radio astronomy did have a major future in the galactic structure area. We've seen at this symposium how strong the radio astronomy has become in this area.
Sure. What was the motivation of NRL? Did they want an optical astronomer to beef up the astronomy side of things, do you think?
I don't know why NRL was interested in an optical astronomer per se. They, of course, had been in radio astronomy, had gotten into it from radar,
right.
Wartime radar, and certainly had equipment in the forefront of the field in the particularly the high-frequency
right.
work, higher frequencies, getting into the low centimeter and even the millimeter region. The person who hired me was Hagen, and then by the time I got there, Hagen had left for Project Vanguard.
I see.
And actually, I don't know whether this is something you want to write, but I found out, years later, that I was a real embarrassment when I came to NRL, that they really didn't know what the group, Hagen had hired me and then left, and the people who were there then just hadn't the slightest idea what they were going to do with me.
So primarily, it must have been just solely his initiative. And
I think so. I think he may have felt, and this is something to check with him,
right.
that someone with a more classical astronomical
right.
background
right.
could provide some ballast to the group.
And right.
I think without being egotistical, that I eventually proved to be rather useful, and I think they were genuinely sorry to have me leave. The main reason I left was not that I didn't still believe in the potential of galactic structure, but of radio astronomy and galactic structure, but in that era, you essentially had to build your own equipment.
Right.
And the people who did build the equipment weren't terribly happy about sharing it with someone who hadn't taken part in the construction. And while I was still enthusiastic about the science to come out of it, I just didn't feel like I wanted to start over and become an electronic engineer.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was beginning to look around for another job by the time I did the job in NASA did come up, although I had certain regrets.
Yeah. No, just to get it straight now, you left NRL in what year?
Early 59.
So we're talking about 3.5 years.
Three and a half years, yes.
So at NRL. Well, what did you find when you came to this group? What were they working on, and what was the style of the group and so forth?
Well, the style of the group was fairly individualistic. Lilly, I think, was there at the time. If not, he came shortly afterwards. He and McLean were working on 21 centimeter work pretty well exclusively. In the 21 centimeter area, Towns was beginning to come down with a graduate student of his.
Bringing his Maser.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the graduate student's name.
Alsop or Jardimain?
No, he's Jardimain. He's now at Bell Labs. It was Jardimain. And they were beginning the work of a Maser for hydrogen line work. They actually did get it on the telescope, but not while I was there in a very useful, practical way. Bob Coates was working on the sun at
8 millimeters,
and actually trying to get into 4 millimeter work on the sun, and did do some 4 millimeter work on the sun in spite of the fact that the climate in the Washington area is not ideal. I worked on this 400 megacycle survey with Ben Yapley. Again, he built the equipment. And
who was it that decided? Was it pretty much just what everyone did what he wanted to in these?
Pretty much, yeah. You know,
there wasn't any overall director who was trying to coordinate.
Well, McLean,
things.
Of course, was the director, but people had pretty much a free hand. Like any other organization, you had to go in and argue for the money, but if you could convince people that what you wanted to do was sensible, you had a free hand. Yapley, of course, was working on the lunar radar. Grant was working primarily, he did a little bit of work in radio astronomy, but he was working primarily on backscattering characteristics of water surface, the sort of thing that Yapley has gotten into more recently.
I don't know this fellow, Grant.
Charles Grant. Hmm. He's now at Goddard. I guess he's now retired. He was at Goddard for quite a while. That was one. There actually were two major pieces of work that were going on that were of particular interest to the Navy. Although the Navy was very interested in the lunar radar work too, for reasons that later became obvious. But
you're referring to the whole Sugar Grove thing and so forth.
Right. But Grant was doing this backscattering work from the sea surface as a measure of sea state. And I actually got involved with that fairly deeply for a while also. And then the other piece of work that was going on that I got involved with to a small extent, although not terribly productively, was the question of navigation under cloud cover.
Radio sextants,
that type of thing.
Well, let me ask, since you brought it up about the point of view of the Navy. Of course, ONR did a lot of funding in the late 50s.
Right.
And this would just be another example of it. Was there motivation military in all respects, or were they?
No, I don't think so. I think ONR basically felt that the country would be served by strong basic research. And while most of the ONR work had to be justified by some sort of military tie-in, the people who did the justifying and the people who accepted the justification accepted very, very broad interpretations of what was a military interest.
Yeah. And so this was really for Congress's benefit more than?
I don't know whose benefit it was from.
It
was done and it was honest, but to be perfectly honest, the major initiative, both on the part of people like the scientists at NRL and of the people in ONR who were funding university groups, was to try to support good basic research.
Right.
Now, it wasn't entirely that. Clearly, a lot of the radio astronomy work which they were supporting had clear spinoff in the development of receiver techniques and the development, for that matter, even of antenna techniques. But I think basically the receiver techniques and pushing the forefront of technology in receivers is probably the main military interest in the work.
Although you could probably do this more efficiently by just developing sensitive receivers.
No, I don't think you could.
No?
I search doesn't work that way. You don't just say, you know, develop a better receiver without having an idea of what you're going to do with the receiver. And also you want to actually use the receiver,
yeah,
because you improve it by using it and finding out what's
right
wrong with it as you work with it. And by supporting radio astronomy, they were able to get the receiver development done in the universities on an unclassified basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just radio astronomy, not just receivers, but research in general has proved much more productive on a non-classified basis.
That's an interesting comment. People are perhaps more motivated when they're when they have something to go after.
I think they're more motivated when they have something to go after. I think that, as I say, I think the fact that it's important to try them out, fiddle with them as you're working
right
with them is a help. I think that simply the fact that being unclassified, you know whom you're competing with, you have the sense of competition, but you also have the sense of sharing
right
information. So both things
proper stimulated.
Proper
scientific sphere, so
mm-hmm
to speak. And you don't think it was particularly different in NRL than the university funding?
Not really, except
yeah
I think that there was a certain incentive for those of us at NRL to try to tackle some problems which were specifically Navy problems, partly because we became more aware of them, partly because there were people at NRL who were working these problems and they'd talk with us.
Right,
now, there's
sure
just a communication interchange that would get us involved
yeah
in some
sure
of these things.
In
fact, I found myself at NRL getting involved with things that were far removed from astronomy simply because, being an astronomer by training, I had some optics background. Well, there was an optics group at NRL that
mm-hmm
was very good, but I had a different view.
Mm-hmm.
I was familiar with remote sensing
right
in a way,
exactly, sure, that's
and
what we
radiation
do
transfer and problems like that. So
mm-hmm
I got involved in quite a number of things outside of astronomy per se, simply because I had a background which was different from most of the
yeah
people there.
While I'm asking general questions before we get to specifics, is to what do you attribute the success of the NRL group at that time? It was one of the leading ones in the world, of course. What do you think were the key ingredients?
Well, I think it was first the foresight of Hagen in getting the 50-foot dish and in pushing techniques to higher and higher frequency. I think secondly, they had a very good, competent group of people. I think
mm-hmm
Coates, with his receiver work at very high frequencies, was probably as good as anyone available. McLean getting Towns and Jordamain down there to push the hydrogen work. Frankly, they probably had more funding than most of the
mm-hmm
radio astronomy groups at that time.
Yeah, that's true also. Yeah. Okay, let's go back to specifically what you worked on. What was the first project you got involved in?
Well, you can probably tell that from my papers
well,
better than I can remember.
Was it this one with Haddock on modeling non-thermal radio
yeah
sources?
Yeah, I think that probably was very early, because I'm not basically a theorist, as you may know if you've
yeah
looked at any of my rest of my
yeah
my record. And I don't think I would have gotten... Well, I wouldn't have tackled a theoretical problem as a major problem. It was just something that, you know, you get into a group, you start talking. In fact, as I say, when I got to NRL, I was an embarrassment because they weren't quite sure what they wanted to do with me. And I was coming into a government laboratory, and I thought, well, this will be very different from a university. They'll have a very specific job they want me to do,
mm-hmm,
and they'll tell me what they want. And I got
yeah
there, and they were all very polite, and introduced me around, and gave me a desk. That was it. And I had a policy in Bracewell's book on radio astronomy, and I decided, well, I'll sit down and read that and learn something about the field.
Right.
I got through that, and still nobody had suggested anything for me, so I decided, well, it's about time for me to keep myself busy. And I had brought enough work with me enough optical work that I didn't have any problems keeping busy, and I just saw to it that I'd talk to people at lunch, and I'd go around and see what they were doing,
mm-hmm,
and just began to get involved with the work there, and I think that's how I got involved with Haddock on this theoretical paper. It was just, we talked about things, and I'd start thinking.
Do you remember the main thrust of what you were getting at in this
no,
paper?
No, I don't, as a matter of fact.
I haven't had a chance to look at anything more than a two-sentence summary myself. Yeah. Can you remember more the general state of what radio sources were thought to be? I mean, was it clear that they were synchrotron radiation?
No, not at that time.
In 56?
I don't think so. I think the synchrotron explanation really didn't come out until 57 or 8, if I remember rightly. Well, my memory's pretty bad.
Well, no, Shalsky suggested it in 53.
Or was it that long? Well, then I guess the answer is yes, the synchrotron must have been accepted
then. No, he suggested it, but it did not have general acceptance in the West until many years later, so I think your statement is probably right. As far as
you've been looking into this lately, and I'm afraid I haven't.
Okay.
One of the things I find with time is that chronology gets confused.
Sure. Going down my list.
I guess really the symposium in Paris in about 58
was
the time when the non-thermal explanation really began to be accepted
for the background and for sources.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But speaking of such things, you were an editor for the 2IU symposium on the same subject as this one, the structure of our galaxy. And I would be interested in how you saw the intermingling of radio and optical techniques for going at this particular problem, or in general. Or was it pretty much people not talking to each other?
It was very much people not talking with one another. I was unusual, I won't say unique, in trying to work in radio astronomy with an astronomical background. Now in Holland, Oort had gotten beginning to get a group together that had both astronomy. It had had an astronomy background and was getting involved in radio astronomy. But outside of the Dutch group, the radio astronomers and the optical astronomers were really pretty well separate. It was, Ed Lilly was probably the first person who was trained in an astronomy department in radio astronomy. Bach obviously saw the potential of radio astronomy and introduced radio astronomy to the Harvard department.
Right.
But
these are the exceptions.
I think that was the only place in the country at that time where you had radio astronomy in an astronomy department. And as I said, the feeling of radio astronomy groups were that you had to build your own equipment, which means you had to have a very intense electronic engineering background, because the equipment, to be competitive, had to really be in the forefront of the art. And it's just very, very difficult to have the kind of background that you require for that, and at the same time a strong astronomy background. And the groups really did not talk to one another very much in that period.
Even when brought together at these meetings, it was pretty much...
They weren't brought together all that much at these meetings. The radio astronomers really were not getting involved in galactic structure in any significant way at that time.
With the exception, perhaps, of Oort.
With the exception of Oort and the Dutch group, which was a clear exception. And the 21-centimeter work, they were beginning to work into galactic structure problems with that.
And, of course,
but
the whole question
was
the halo.
The question of the halo, and was it real?
Right.
What was
it made of?
But that was more the radio astronomers. And
the optical people didn't get
involved in that very much. I may be divorcing... Divorcing these two groups too strongly in my memory, but my memory is that there really was discouragingly little intercommunication, except in the Dutch group, and the beginnings of it at Harvard under the influence of Bach.
Well, just to follow this line further, how long did this situation go on, or is it still going on?
No, I think it's not going on. I would say it went on until the early 60s. And again, as I said, my chronological memory is not good, but I think by 61 or 62 that the groups were beginning to get together. And certainly the development of groups like the NRAO, where you had a national facility with equipment that was available to people, meant that people with an astronomical background could begin to get into the field without having the problems of designing their own.
Right.
Building their own.
Well, I think I would agree with you for the American case, but...
The Australians were beginning to get in a little earlier.
Well,
the British...
No, I mean as far as this amalgamation into astronomy as a whole.
The British really don't think they got together much sooner than we did. Do you?
No. I'm saying that...
It was later.
Later.
Yeah, okay.
And one can argue that still the radio groups are very distinct. I mean, not as much as they used to.
No. I don't know that they're that much more distinct now.
But they've never developed the philosophy, though, of the national facility that you just come and use as an optical astronomer.
Yeah, that's right. But, I think that British radio astronomers and optical astronomers have been talking for the last decade.
Oh, yes.
But,
I didn't mean to say that.
Yeah, and even Australia, you know, there it was the radio astronomers that developed it, and they didn't really get together very strongly with the optical astronomers, except in the solar area,
right,
until fairly late. Now, in the solar area, they did. The solar astronomers got together with radio quite early, Jim Vannelli and that group.
I was just down there talking to them a few months ago. Mm. Now, the next publication I had that you were involved with was with Ben Yapley, to do with 440 megahertz.
Yeah, right. And that was the major thing that I did do.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea there was to try to... Well, there had been mapping of the galaxy at lower frequencies, and you had this non-thermal background, and it was an attempt to extend it down and bridge the gap between the 21-centimeter line, where there was both continuum and line survey work, and the low-frequency
surveys. Was this using the 84-foot dish?
No.
The
84-foot didn't exist at that time.
Right.
This was using the 50-foot dish at NRL, which was an interesting experience in itself, as you can guess.
Well, in what sense now? What do you mean?
Well, we were 2 miles from National Airport,
right,
with airplanes flying in all night.
Loads of interference.
Yeah, I got beautiful radar echoes from the airplanes every time one landed.
Oh, I see. You mean actual direct interference from the planes. I was thinking of radar interference from all the activity.
Well, what you got was radar reflected off the planes coming into the dish and saturating the dish every time there was an airplane in your beam. And, of course, you could not work in the daytime because the noise, the area was just much too noisy. And even at night, we had serious interference problems at times. So,
what about the dish itself? Was the pointing adequate for what you
wanted
to do?
The pointing was adequate. And the dish itself, well, of course, the dish was designed to go down for the 21-centimeter work. And it actually was pretty good at 21 centimeters. So at 67 centimeters, it was no problem at all. It was not the easiest dish to operate. It was an old gun mount.
Right.
And another, the thing I remember most vividly about it is that it's a solid dish, and it was stowed face up.
Right.
And so after it rained, you went out to move the. You had to move the dish outside. There were controls outside for repointing it. Once you had it locked, it would track automatically. But you had to go outside to.
Were you
to
cranking
set it.
Or pushing buttons?
No, you were pushing, well, it wasn't, but it was neither one, they were levers.
I see. Okay.
Handles. You go out there after a rain and point the dish and you were doused with a good shower of water, to put it mildly.
It's still stowed there, of course. Right?
It's still stowed there. I don't see much evidence that they use it very much anymore.
No, I don't think they use it at all.
Then, of course, I was involved with the 84-foot. That was finished just before I left.
In what sense were you involved in the design?
I wasn't involved much in the design. I was involved in some of the siting and particularly such jobs as the alignment of the polar axis, that type of thing. Things where an astronomical background would enter.
But what about the actual survey itself at 440? What was the main things that came out of that?
The thing that I remember most vividly, and this was not the 440 as much as it was putting the 440 and together with the other frequencies, was the complexity of the galactic center area. Beyond that, I frankly at this point don't remember a great deal that came out of it. Clearly we did show that the radiation was beginning to be condensed to the galactic plane. We did not pick up the absorption that they were picking up at the higher frequencies, so it continued to peak as you go to lower galactic latitudes. And we did pick up a few sources, but I don't that we well we did contribute to the spectra of
things like Cygnus A.
Yeah, the various point sources, the strong point sources. I don't remember it as being a terribly earth-shaking paper, right, to be perfectly honest.
Well, it just struck me that perhaps the main survey you had to compare with was Reber's back in 48.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, there was also the Cambridge survey. There was an early Cambridge survey.
And not at 480?
No, not at 480.
Yeah,
no, there's nothing
at 480. Well,
no,
Reber's was at 480.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, okay.
Except
there was nothing modern.
Right, right.
You
had much higher sensitivity than
yes,
you
Yes, very much, right. And better beam width.
Right. Well, not terrible.
Somewhat.
30 versus 50, yeah.
Yeah, I think we had a somewhat better dish, too.
Yeah, no, that's certainly
And better pointing.
Okay, moving on. Then it seems that you also got involved in the radar astronomy effort.
Yeah,
Which was led by Ben Yapley,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Well, there again, the main contribution that I guess I made was the astronomical background, the motion of the moon.
What was libration and all this sort of thing.
Yeah, right. We did get involved somewhat with a bit of mapping of the moon along with in that lunar radar work.
Right. Was this the first time that any mapping had been done?
To the best of my knowledge,
I got that impression from the abstracts here. Mm-hmm. You used 2 microsecond pulses. And
the only other lunar radar work that I can remember going on at that time was the work at Fort Monmouth, which of course was the first group to actually get a signal
way back
from
in 46,
the moon.
Yeah.
But
so they were active in the late 50s also?
They were still active in the late 50s,
I didn't realize
yes.
That.
But I don't think that, I don't know whether they just weren't using as sharp pulses we were using or what. They were definitely our competitors, but mm-hmm. I don't really think that they were as strong competition as we gave them credit for.
Yeah, yeah. How did this idea come up? I mean, was this just radar people's...
I think so. I think,
you know, well, let's see what we can do with the moon. Or?
Yeah, I think that was largely it. There was another program that people at NRL were involved in also that may have originally stimulated the idea of radar from the moon. I don't really know. And that was the study of so-called angels, atmospheric phenomena, and from which they got radar echoes. Now, clearly some of the radar echoes were from insects. They had identified that. But they were also getting radar echoes from atmospheric discontinuities.
Right, is this what you call troposcatter now?
Well, it probably was at least partially.
Yeah.
I imagine I haven't followed tropospheric scattering and our angels either one in detail since. My guess is yes, I think probably it also has to do, also is not unrelated to the clear air turbulence problem.
Right.
Where they are finding that radar, but at well, not higher frequencies, because some of this angel work was at 1.25 centimeter, the water vapor line, and or near the water vapor line. So
this was going on in the radio astronomy branch?
Mm-hmm. To some extent, not strongly
right.
at that time, but there was enough, there had been, before my time, there had been a substantial amount of work on angels. In the branch, and I wouldn't be surprised if in the course of looking at things, echoes that they might not have picked up the moon at some time and taken it from there. I don't really know. I think it was basically that they had the dish, they had the capability. Fort Monmouth had done it. It was clear that we had the capability. It was a sensible thing to do with under the circumstances.
And then I guess while you were involved in the radars, about when you left.
Yes. Yes, it was still going on. In fact, it continued for another 10 years after I left.
Yeah, I worked there for the first summer in that branch in 66 and helped observe,
mm-hmm.
And I think it ended just about then, 67 or so.
Mm-hmm.
One final question is, you got involved in space astronomy in NASA, and part of that space astronomy was radio astronomy, which I guess Fred Haddock was one of the key men. Could you just tell me how...
Well, Haddock was involved.
Just a brief outline of how that came about.
My memory of the names is
horrible.
Oh,
I think Walsh?
Walsh. Was Dennis Walsh was with Haddock. No, I want to say Panagakis. He's a man at NASA now. Papagian.
Oh, Papagianis or whatever.
Yeah,
Papagianis. The guy at Boston.
In Boston.
Right.
Was involved at Harvard in those days. And it was a little later that Stone came to Goddard and got involved with what was finally developed into the Radio Astronomy Explorer.
Right.
Now, you asked me a question.
Well, I was just saying, how did this come about? Was this purely Haddock's idea in NASA was there, and so we tried to get
some money? Partly yes, partly no. The idea when I first went to NASA was to try to set up an astronomy program, and my feeling was that we should try to get observations in the entire spectral range that was not accessible from the ground. And clearly, one of those ranges was the very low frequency radio range. And so I was on the lookout for something in that area. And as I say, both Haddock and Papagiannis, working with the Lilly, as a matter of fact, were interested in that. The Harvard group got support from the Air Force, and we supported Haddock for the rocket work. Now, obviously, it was clear we had to go quite high. The program was not terribly productive, primarily because the electromagnetic interference in the rocket proved to be essentially insurmountable. Although, actually, by the end of the program, Haddock was beginning to get results. The first flights were pretty well useless, simply because of interference. But by the end, he was getting quite enough information to get data. But he was obviously, in hindsight, running into the same thing that killed REEA, and that was the atmospheric, magnetospheric noise.
I didn't realize that there was a first satellite that was in too low an orbit or something.
Well, we had two satellites. The first one was not in a low orbit. It was in a pretty high orbit, but it was an Earth orbit. And the magnetosphere turns out, of the Earth turns out to be stronger than the magnetosphere of Jupiter.
Yeah.
So that it was just a very noisy background. So we put the second one in orbit around the moon so that the moon would act as an occulting screen. So we got a fair amount of solar data from the first one, but I would be tempted to say that the amount of galactic data that came out of the first radio astronomy explorer was pretty minimal.
Right. But this now is up into 68.
Yeah, this has
or
been
a,
no. Well, it wasn't quite.
When the first radio astronomy explorer went
was out. It that late? Didn't remember that it was quite that late, but. It certainly was getting, it's later than your period that you're worrying about. In fact, even Haddock's work is outside, is after 60,
I'm not
I think.
Rigidly cutting off at 60, but how long did Haddock's work go on, roughly? Can you remember?
Oh, I imagined all around 65.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well,
that's just a guess, but it's about that.
For more details. Well, that pretty well covers it.
Okay.
Unless you can think of any other comments that.
But you were asking for personal experiences.
Yes.
I think one of I said I could give you a human interest story. When we put up the 84-foot dish down at Maryland Point, there was obviously a question of facilities.
Ah, yes.
So there was a trailer, which was sort of the general.
I know that trailer.
Yes. And so they put up Villa Roman. I don't know if you ever ran into that.
No,
they put up a separate little house so I would have a place to stay.
So the men were in the trailer, and you had a separate little shack.
Yeah, the amusing thing is that the one night I spent down there was so cold, I moved into the trailer with the men.
So you only used this thing half a night or something?
Yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Nancy Roman on 16th June, 78.